I will now pass it over to Joe LaManna, who will open today's call.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for getting on today's call. I know you are all busy supporting your communities and frankly, the nation at large. So I want to first start by thanking everyone for all that you do. I know this is a difficult time for everybody, but together we're getting through this. There's been a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of hard work that's being done out there. And today we have some great, a great lineup of speakers. So look forward to hearing about that information exchange and look forward to hearing from all of you out there. Again, thank you for joining. And for today, I'd like to start off by handing off to our lead for Asper Tracy, Ms. Shane Brandman. So Shane, take it away.
Thanks, Mr. LaManna, and good afternoon, shipmates. As Joe just alluded to, it's been a long haul here, and we're just so grateful for your continued collaboration and what you do daily to help protect and ensure the advanced capabilities of your community. So again, thank you. It's been a busy year for Asper Tracy. By the end of 2020, we had recorded our 1 millionth visitor to our website and answered over 8,200 requests for technical assistance. We developed over 100 new resources just in 2020 alone, which are all listed along with other key accomplishments and resources in our Asper Tracy developed digest for calendar year 2020, which will be included in the HVP outreach this week. In case you missed it, we also developed a hospital operational toolkit for COVID-19 to help emergency managers and planners manage large number of patients during the pandemic. The toolkit covers considerations from before patients arrive at a hospital to after they are discharged. We continue to add presentations as part of our healthcare operations during the COVID-19 pandemic speaker series. New presentations in January included the Baltimore Convention Center Field Hospital Informatics Team discussing the use of electronic health records at the surge facility, and Dr. Fields from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services discussing their statewide approach in support of monoclonal antibiotic therapy in various healthcare settings. So please check those out if you haven't done so already. Just this afternoon, and that's why you don't see my face because we're getting it out on the street right now. We just released a document I really want to bring to everyone's attention, and that's the Healthcare System Cybersecurity Incident Readiness and Response Considerations document that was developed in coordination with Nebraska Medicine, MedStar Health, and Hennepin Healthcare. We will be hosting a webinar on the same topic on March 18th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And by next Friday, we'll have a Tracy Express with all that information. And again, we'll be socializing that through the HVP outreach as well. But please take a look at that cyber document. It's very, very well done and something that I think will be useful to many of you. And on other issues besides just COVID, I just want to bring to your attention that this spring we'll be releasing a Healthcare Coalition Burn Surge Annex Tabletop Template to complement the Healthcare Coalition Burn Cynic Annex Template that we developed before. And later this year, we'll also be working on a Healthcare Coalition Radiation Surge Annex Template to help coalitions meet the at FOA requirement. Again, be sure to sign up for Asper Tracy's distribution list so that you can make sure that you get the most up-to-date information. We're continually updating all of our resources. And again, to everyone on the line, thank you for your continued support and collaboration for Asper Tracy. And now it's my distinct pleasure to pass it to Jennifer Hanna, one of the most hardest working professionals within Asper. Jennifer.
Thank you, Shane. And good afternoon, everyone. First, I wanted to provide a friendly reminder to all of the HPP Annual Cooperative Agreement recipients who received an extension to review, complete, and return their budget period one end of year data verification file by the end of today. And if you have any questions, please reach out to our Sharper team at their Sharper mailbox at sharper@hhs.gov. Also, I wanted to provide an update regarding the status of the FY 2021 Budget Period 3 Continuation Application Instructions. Barring any delays or any issues, we anticipate that the continuation application instructions will be available in Grant Solutions by the end of next week. Next slide, please. I wanted to bring to your attention that we now have available a story from the field submission form. ASPR is always interested in hearing about the impact you are making in your regions with your ASPR cooperative agreement funding. Your stories are essential to ASPR in addressing various resource requests and demonstrating the value and impact of the cooperative agreement programs nationwide. To better support you in sharing your story, our team has created a brief online story from the field submission form. This form includes questions to guide you in submitting information on your preparedness, response, and recovery activity or activities. It also includes a field to upload any documents, resources, or pictures you'd like to include with your story. Whether you have a few bullet points, a couple of paragraphs, or a full narrative to share, we encourage you to use this form. Final stories are published on the Healthcare Readiness Action and webpage on PHE.gov and shared also via our Healthcare Readiness Bulletin. Our team will insert the link to the form in the chat for easy reference. Okay, thank you, Maria. Next slide, please. Our final update is regarding the Healthcare Readiness Bulletin. Beginning next week, our Healthcare Readiness Bulletin will be moving to a new platform that provides new functionality, including new subscribe and unsubscribe options. This bulletin, as you know, provides the latest news and information related to ASPR's healthcare readiness program, including important cooperative agreement updates and deadlines, as well as links to a variety of emergency preparedness and response tools and resources. There are two items that we want to point out before you receive next week's bulletin. First, the bulletin will now be coming from donotreply@connect.hhs.gov. Please add this to your approved email addresses so the bulletin is not routed to your spam folder. If not already on your approved email list, you may receive an Outlook alert when you first receive the bulletin. We recommend that you add the email address to your safe senders list so you can view all of the images. Second, while everyone who currently receives the bulletin already has been subscribed, you can manage your subscription at any time by selecting the Manage Subscriptions link at the bottom of each bulletin. If you or your colleagues do not receive the bulletin and would like to, please subscribe by typing the URL on this slide into your browser. We will also insert this link in the chat and will include it in the bulletin each week. If you attempt to subscribe to the bulletin but are unable to subscribe, if you're unable to submit the form, that means that you are already subscribed to receive the distribution. I will now hand it off to Rick Hunt to share a few updates on the Project ECHO COVID-19 clinical round. Rick?
Thanks very much, Jennifer. Appreciate the opportunity to provide a brief update on COVID-19 clinical rounds. For those of you who aren't familiar with COVID-19 clinical rounds, the purpose of those rounds are peer-to-peer, real-time sharing of COVID-19 challenges and successes, both regarding patient care and clinical operations. This is a voluntary public-private collaboration, and it involves multiple collaborating organizations, mostly professional societies and federal departments and agencies. They are not intended to be redundant or replace any organization's initiatives. They are intended to be sharing of clinical experience rather than recommendations or guidance. They are definitely not your usual webinar. Thanks especially to the National Emerging Special Pathogen Training and Education Center, NETEC, for their support with the rounds. And as it turns out, many of you probably noticed that their webinars complement Project ECHO's COVID-19 clinical rounds. A quick word about Project ECHO, just because ECHO gets connected with the rounds. Indeed, it's connected with the rounds. Project ECHO is based out of the University of New Mexico has been around for quite some time, and they provide our peer-to-peer learning platform for the actual rounds. In terms of upcoming ECHO COVID-19 clinical rounds, they are currently US noon Eastern time. Mondays are EMS rounds, Tuesdays are critical care, and Thursdays are emergency department rounds. Tomorrow will be our 120th rounds. That one will be focused on mental wellness, and we're gonna cross disciplines for sure with emergency medicine and emergency psychiatry on those rounds. In terms of the participants for our rounds, they come from all states and usually a few other countries. For each session, we have a wide range of disciplines who participate on each rounds. The vast majority are physicians, nurses, and EMS clinicians. From March 24th through February 4th, there have been 43,733 participants, and the archived videos have been viewed by 12,113 individuals. There have been some surprises. And first of all, these are not webinars. They're peer-to-peer learning sessions. And as far as we're aware, this format has never been done for a disaster in this way before. And this happens to be the largest disaster in a century. So what has been particularly surprising is we've had for each of the rounds, no matter what the topic, it can be acute kidney injury to EMS, COVID-19, and riots. We have about, on average, about a third participants are physicians, a third nurses, and a third EMS clinicians. So we've developed some robust interdisciplinary connections through the rounds. We've had rounds that have connected the ICU intensivists with long-term care. We've had EMS connected to the best experts we have in monoclonal antibodies today. So that robust connectivity has been a surprise. And then the other has been a willingness on the part of the participants to have a deep appreciation that we still need to take care of patients and operate our facilities and our EMS agencies when at times there is no evidence base, which is counterintuitive, but that's where we are. Some trends that we see right now, certainly there have been big topics for the rounds, include crisis care, fatigue for healthcare providers, staff shortages for sure, and also the emergence of variants, in particular, a topic that's popped up even in the past week is some new clinical patterns that have been seen by clinicians. So with that, that gives you an overview where we are, an update on some of the topics that we're embarking on, or we have all gone on the journey together, as Joe LaManna indicated. With that, I'm gonna turn this over to our next speaker, Melinda Southard, to share a few spotlights from Nevada. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hunt. My name is Melinda Southard, and I'm the State Program Manager for the Public Health Preparedness Program for the Nevada Division of Public and Behavioral Health. And I just wanted to speak with you a little bit today about crisis standards of care and some of the different activities we've done in Nevada. Next slide, please. Oh, sorry, next slide. Okay, so first off, I want to give you a little bit of a background. Our Nevada Crisis Standards of Care Plan was finalized in June of 2017. So then we were all very happy and proud that we had this beautiful plan. And then we decided, okay, now we got to operationalize it. We've got to kind of test the waters and see if the documentation that we've put out there, is this actually going to work? So over the next year or so, we planned out a crisis standards of care workshop to include members of the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee that we had mentioned within the plan that would be basically the decision makers in developing those crisis standards of care recommendations. So we wanted the opportunity to get all those people in the same room, number one, to meet each other face to face, because that always helps. Especially in emergency, we all know that those relationships are paramount. And then also to just kind of discuss crisis standards of care, because it is such a, just a complex concept. And then, you know, how are we going to basically publish those recommendations? So this is a picture of the workshop. It's in our State Emergency Operations Center up here in Carson City, Nevada. And as you can see, it was really well attended. So we had members, you know, from the Board of Pharmacy, Nevada Hospital Association, State Board of Nursing. And then we had asked our ASPR Regional Emergency Coordinator to come in and be the facilitator for this workshop. So it all came together really nicely. Next slide, please. So some improvement items that came out of this workshop was that we had initially called for the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee. However, being a committee within the state structure, because you know, we all have to adhere to that lovely open meeting law for any committee that is state developed, it's state convened. So instead of being a committee, we decided to turn it into a team. So still State Disaster Medical Advisory Team. And that allowed us the flexibility to not be bound by those open meeting laws. And then additionally, to involve your public information officers in crisis standards of care dissemination to other partners. And then also, you know, just to ensure that the message is getting across and that it's well understood. And then better information sharing with our healthcare coalitions. So we had not done a really great job in continuing the conversation surrounding crisis standards of care with our coalitions since we had finalized the plan in 2017. So we really wanted to continue to engage those important partners in that conversation. And so that was one of the items that I'll talk about here shortly. And then when I talk about widen the EPON pool, so EPON is our name for the Emergency Providers of Nevada. So this is a way for us to basically have a registration form where people could sign up to participate and potentially be called upon to be a part of the State Disaster Medical Advisory Team in a crisis standards of care type scenario. So it was a way to basically have a list of, you know, subject matter experts in different areas of expertise that we could call upon depending on what type of incident called for potential activation of crisis standards of care. So we really wanted to basically widen that pool to include more various areas of expertise. And then along with that item about information sharing with healthcare coalitions, we decided that we wanted to continue to engage those key players that were a part of our EPON group that basically would be needed in any type of crisis standards of care conversation or scenario. So we decided to have a select group of about 7 of those EPON members that we could call upon to consult with at least quarterly throughout the year. And so we set up meetings to basically talk about crisis standards of care topics and continue to engage those members and cultivate those relationships between that group for better information sharing. Next slide, please. So our State Disaster Medical Advisory Team, the core group that makes up that team currently in Nevada is listed here. And one of the new additions would be that of the governor's office. In Nevada, our governor had appointed a medical advisory team to assist with COVID-19 specific recommendations surrounding, you know, medical recommendations for our state. So we really wanted to ensure that that group was also included in our crisis standards of care recommendations and discussion. Additionally, you know, the SDMAT technical specialist and SDMAT planning, those are both components of the public health preparedness program in Nevada. So we have staff that that play in those roles. Next slide, please. So regarding our healthcare coalition workshops, it says that we were able to complete 2, but it's actually, we were only able to complete 1 of our healthcare coalition workshops before COVID hit. So just speaking of that one workshop though, it was so beneficial to have that true conversation with members of the coalition in Nevada to talk about, you know, what does crisis standards of care really mean and what does it mean to activate it? You know, what types of considerations do we need to talk about before we activate crisis standards of care in Nevada and ensure that we have all the appropriate partners at the table? So that was a really great conversation. Shortly thereafter, next slide, please. As we all know, COVID kind of exploded in the United States. So we were unable to continue with those coalition workshops. And shortly thereafter, also, we had to activate our crisis standards of care plan. Next slide, please. So on March 20th is when Nevada activated our statewide crisis standards of care plan. So this was the base plan that had included all those improvement items from that workshop and had just been published, I think maybe a week before. So talk about good timing. And basically, you know, it was nice. We had this great base plan for how crisis standards of care was going to be activated and implemented in Nevada. But we realized shortly that it didn't have the details that we needed specifically surrounding COVID-19. So the governor, as I talked about before, had appointed the medical advisory team, and we convened the EPON group along with the medical advisory team to basically make up our state disaster medical advisory team for the state to talk about crisis standards of care and what that specific document was going to look like. And then the addition of the Emergency Directive 11 in Nevada is actually what really facilitated crisis standards of care implementation and approvals moving forward. So this directive allows for a lot of flexibilities regarding healthcare and just the healthcare continuum in Nevada, and was really beneficial in crisis standards of care. So that was activated on April 1st. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, the recommendation flow for how these crisis standards of care guidance were disseminated throughout the state. Next slide, please. So this is just a quick picture to kind of show, you know, how that flow works. So we have the state disaster medical advisory team convenes, develops these recommendations, and then we submit them to the state emergency operations center, which includes in a time of emergency, the state policy group. The state policy group is inclusive of those department heads that would be directly involved in the particular response. So for COVID-19, that included the director of the Department of Health and Human Services, the administrator for the Division of Public and Behavioral Health, the chief for the Division of Emergency Management, as well as the governor and the governor's office. So our crisis standards of care recommendations are then set forward to that group to put the final approval on it. And then once they approve it, then it's sent back through the State Emergency Operations Center to the ESF-8 desk, Emergency Support Function 8, which is also public health and medical. And the Nevada Public Health Preparedness Program is the staff that basically manages that desk. So then we get those recommendations back and we send them out to our local health authorities, our local emergency operations centers, and local healthcare facilities. Next slide, please. So as I had mentioned before, you know, we needed that specific crisis level guidance for COVID-19. Like, although we had a great base plan for crisis standards of care, we really needed to drill it down to the level for a novel pandemic. So we utilized, you know, the CDC guidance and have updated it along with the updated CDC guidance, as well as our, you know, best practice and peer reviewed guidance. And that was all coordinated with, you know, the governor's office, chief medical officer for the state, medical advisory team, and the state disaster medical advisory team. So, and then we heavily rely on our partners with the healthcare coalitions and the Nevada Hospital Association to really assist the local hospitals, and healthcare system in applying those crisis level guidance to the healthcare system at the local level. Next slide, please. So where are we now? So Nevada Crisis Standards of Care does remain activated. We anticipate deactivation to occur, you know, when the state of emergency is lifted. And then in our plan, it says it will only occur when all healthcare facilities are able to return to standards of care that are lower than the crisis level, obviously. So we anticipate that happening along with the deactivation of the state of emergency. But we are continuing to have those discussions with the EPON group on how, you know, how exactly it's going to look for Nevada to deactivate crisis standards of care. And so our crisis standards of care for COVID is definitely a living document, currently in its fifth iteration as of December. And generally when we publish new updates, we also publish a one-page update summary sheet that kind of bulletizes those important updates because the document itself, I think, is 130 something pages long. So it is getting to be quite comprehensive. All right, and with that, I will turn it over to our partners at Sunrise Hospital to discuss the monoclonal antibody infusion clinic. Thank you.
Todd, are you on mute?
Yep, there we go.
Okay.
There we go. Okay, so we'll start over again. I was thanking Melinda for all the great work from the state and all the state's assistance in allowing us not just to stand up the monoclonal antibody clinic, but all of the state support as we've been dealing with the pandemic now for a year. By introduction, my name is Todd Sklenberg. I have the privilege of holding the position as Chief Executive Officer for Sunrise Hospital and Medical Center. We're a 762-bed facility located here in Las Vegas, just a couple of miles from the Strip, and we're the largest single-campus acute care hospital in the state. Now, I'm going to make a couple of introductory remarks and then turn it over to Dr. Murda, who's going to run through a little bit about our clinic COVID experience and experience with monoclonal antibodies. Just as a little background, Sunrise Hospital has now discharged well over 2,500 COVID-19 patients to date, and I believe we have the largest number of discharges here in Las Vegas. And over the New Year's holiday, Dr. Murda gave me a call, and he said, "I just got a call from the Board of Pharmacy in the state, asking if we would partner with Healthy Human Services and ASPR and open up the third monoclonal antibody clinic in the country." After about 15 seconds of discussion, we said, absolutely. And to date, we've provided over 300 infusion treatments that Dr. Murda is going to review here in a moment. And just want to extend my thanks, and we are just so grateful to Healthy Human Services and ASPR, for the opportunity, as well as all of the support and boots on the ground support to make this a reality. Next page, please. Next page. And just want to acknowledge, many of the partners on this very heavy lift. As I referenced, the thanks to ASPR, our colleagues at the State of Nevada, Health and Human Services, the Board of Pharmacy, Clark County, all the support we received from the Southern Nevada Health District, as well as the Division of Emergency Management for the state. And also want to acknowledge the two DMAT teams, both from Connecticut and New York, that played an integral role in both helping us stand up and support the clinic. So let me turn it over to Dr. Murda, our Chief Medical Officer, who's now been here at Sunrise for about 9 weeks and had the opportunity as one of his first initiatives to help introduce this to the community. Dr. Murda.
Hi, Todd. Thank you. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I've been here about 9 weeks, and what a rocket ship I'm on. I came out of by way of the West Florida Division, HCA. I got asked to come out and look at Sunrise. I didn't know much about Sunrise. I'm an OBGYN by training, had about a year and a half of CMO work working with Hillsborough County EMS, working through the first initial surge of COVID. And when I came out and visited, I was fortunate enough to find a group of individuals that were passionate about healthcare and taking care of the community that they serve. So I said, if you want me, I'll sign up. And about 2 weeks later, with two suitcases, I landed in your wonderful airport, and I came to work. And come to work, I have not stopped. I should have wore sneakers instead of dress shoes. But with that said, we are absolutely blessed and fortunate, and thanking, as Todd did, the incredible work of our federal partners, state partners, county partners. This was an incredible lift. And when he means I called him on New Year's Eve, I called him on New Year's Eve after our government relations spokesperson spoke with the board of pharmacy, Dave Wiest. And he said, hey, you guys want to stand up a monoclonal antibody clinic? And it sounds okay, we can do that. But what you don't realize is we just came off of 2 weeks of getting 2,000 vaccines into our healthcare workers. And we were getting prepared to go to round two. They were tired, they're going to get a little time off. And here I am asking them to stand up this clinic. And when I mean stand up, the DMAT team was arriving on January 8th. So that means we had 7 days to figure out where to put this place, how to staff it, what resources will we need. And I will tell you, our partners, Asper team, they had the manpower, the Board of Pharmacy had the medication, the state and our county partners, they, once we figured it out, they had a tent, and they said, hey, we can get you a tent. So we went through that whole process of, should we put it in our ER? A couple of our sister facilities had done the monoclonal therapy on a very limited scale in the ER. Well, we know that was not possible. We're holding 70 patients in our ER. Our census is 250 of COVID patients. We are at max capacity. It was not going to be able to go inside our hospital. We thought about an infusion center in our MOB out in the back. Well, that's a little too far. What if these patients were to have a problem? What if we needed to get them into the emergency room quickly? So we ultimately decided on a tent just outside our ER, just outside our ambulance bay. Next slide, please. So in about 3 days, we put up this tent, and that group in front of you is our DMAT team from Connecticut. And what an incredible team that was led by Commander Lynn Hayes and Dr. Mike Anderson and Captain Brad Austin. They knew what they were doing. They just stood one of these up in El Centrino. They just brought one online in Tucson, and they knew what was happening. We followed their guidance. We put in the proper EUA. We got the medication. We properly put 10 chairs. We decided to go with an infusion capacity of 10 chairs. We're going to have three seatings, one at 9, one at 1, and one at 4, for a total capacity of 330 a day. We were going to clean the tent between patients. So it was an incredible effort by both the staff here at Sunrise, my operations team, which just every day I work with them, I'm just marvel at these young, really smart people and how they can make almost anything happen. But when we talk about monoclonal therapy, so why did we make that decision? Why did it take Todd 15 seconds to say yes? Well, monoclonal antibody therapy, next slide, please. Is a means to keep the patients out of the hospital. As we all remember, back in March, there was some early considerations for hydroxychloroquine and tocilizumab, but that did not pan out. And we really had very little therapy for that initial phase of the COVID. Other than, yes, you tested positive, go home, put this pulse ox on. And if you go below 92 or 90, you need to come back to the emergency room, because now you're going to get admitted. So when we watch this therapy get approved by the FDA under an EUA, I had kept my eye on it. And when the Board of Pharmacy called me and said, hey, you want to do this? First thing I thought of is, we can keep people out of the hospital. We can keep people from getting sick. I looked at the Blaze 1 trial, which showed that it would reduce infection from 8 days to 6. It showed that there was a potential 10% reduction in hospitalization. And if you think about it, when we were already at capacity, if we could just keep 10% of the COVID patients out of our hospital, and that's extremely conservative, we could keep ourselves from going to that crisis standard of care, which technically we already were in, but we could reduce that need for an alternative care site flowing out of our ICUs into our CMU, into our satellite. So we signed up. Remdesivir was still hot. Steroids came on board after the recovery trial. That's still very popular. Convalescent plasma, it's positive, it's a negative. It depends on who you read. But monoclonal antibody therapy was up and coming. We had the EUA, so we absolutely felt that it was something we needed to offer our community. Next slide, please. And if you want to see what was happening to our community, I've pointed out where right after Thanksgiving, we got the big peak around 12-11. We had about 3,500 cases a day. That graph you're looking at is a rolling 14-day average. We all knew that after Thanksgiving, but we also knew Christmas was here. We also knew New Year's was coming. Unfortunately, we weren't all following the guidance with masking, social distancing, washing your hands. So we expected to get another peak. The second arrow is when we opened up our monoclonal antibody, just as we were starting to peak from the Christmas holidays. Next slide, please. So when I started to think about how many patients would really benefit from this, this is our experience with COVID. We have seen, as Todd said, 2,633 cumulative inpatients. And if you look at the EUA and you look at the age criteria, you hone in on that's a large number of our population that's already been admitted. What if we could have got them the therapy prior to their admission? Could we have prevented those individuals from ultimately needing our services in the hospital? Next slide, please. Here, I'm just trying to show you what were the comorbidities in the groups 20 to 84 and 55 to 64 that would qualify for monoclonal therapy. And it's quite large. Some of those data is in more than one patient has more than one comorbidity. But again, it shows you the demand that the therapy can target and potentially help. Next slide, please. So we brought this online January 8th. We did a media blitz. ASPR was kind enough to bring Dr. Red and Dr. Anderson. We had our media here. We tried to get the word out. We had screening forms. We had order forms. We have a great communication team here at Sunrise. They got us in front of the media, Facebook, social media. We tried to get the word out. And to date, we have now done 302 patients. We continue to, our rate limiting step really is just getting patients to know and understand that this is an option for them and where to go. And we continue to this day try to drive recognition of this opportunity. We're not the only place in Nevada and in Las Vegas that's providing this care, but I think, and again, I don't have the data to support it, we are providing some of the larger percentage of monoclonal therapy to our community. Next slide, please. And I'd like to close out with, again, I want to bring this Sunday, one of our initial family members, husband and wife, heard about a story on January 8th in the paper about this therapy, and both of them came in, they're COVID positive. They came in and had their therapy, and they are convinced that that therapy has saved their lives and kept them out of the hospital. So there's a true believer, there's a testament. I had to throw my picture in there too. I don't get in the paper very often. So I'm a little humbled that I have the opportunity to speak in front of this incredible audience. So thank you very much. And I'll turn it back to you, Todd, for the closing statements. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Murda, for your leadership. And again, this was a team effort with organizations from across the country helping this make a reality. And both Dr. Murda and I went out a little earlier today, and we're ready for the next round of patients coming by today, and look forward to providing the therapy as long as we need. We thought it might be good at this time maybe to pause to see what questions that we can answer from the presentation, either via the chat room or, as suggested, verbally.
Great, thank you, Todd. It looks like we just have one question so far, and this might be for Melinda. So the question is, most emergency operations plans are written utilizing ESF-8 plans. Would it be safe to say the crisis standards of care are not incorporated into these plans? is it a new standard, crisis standard of operation?
Thanks for the question. So in my mind, I think of crisis standards of care, you know, it is a standalone plan, but at the same time, it still has that tie-in to our state emergency. I can't think of what it is called. There's a whole long acronym for it, but it's the state emergency operations plan, basically. While it's a standalone plan, it is incorporated into there and therefore still incorporated into ESF8. So I would hesitate on saying that it's, you know, its own separate entity and not incorporated in any local EOC plans at all. Because I know that we do have those discussions with our local partners and ensuring that everybody is engaged in that conversation and moving forward.
Great, thanks, Belinda. Looks like I don't see any other questions in the chat or hands raised. So in the interest of keeping it moving with our agenda, I think we'll transition to the next speaker. If time allows at the end of the webinar, we might come back to Nevada with some additional questions. So with that, I will pass it over to Dr. Ribner. Dr. Ribner, are you on mute?
Sorry about that. Still getting used to this new technology. Could we have the first slide, please? So, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Bruce Ribner, speaking for NETEC today to update you on the response that NETEC has had to the COVID pandemic. Just as a way of orientation, NETEC was funded in 2015 by ASPR and the Centers for Disease Control as a collaboration between Emory, Nebraska, and Bellevue. And our mission was to improve biopreparedness in the United States. NETEC initially stood for National Ebola Training and Education Center. However, about a year and a half ago, recognizing that Ebola wasn't the only issue that biopreparedness really needed to deal with, we were allowed to change our name, and we're now the National Emerging Special Pathogen Training and Education Center. On the next slide, NETEC carries out its mission by three major types of activities. The first is consultations and metrics. In terms of consultations, we have a robust technical assistance program, which is focused on special areas of concern by individuals contacting NETEC. Individuals can ask an expert a question via email. They can request a review of our procedures by subject matter experts. We offer solutions with discussions based on challenges that various facilities are having. We will offer a virtual review of technical processes such as personal protective equipment utilization. And the major conduit for accessing our technical assistance is through NETEC.org. On the right side of the slide, you see two typical ways in which our assistance can be requested. Someone putting in, I would like to request technical assistance, or I have a question for one of your subject matter experts. On the next slide, as I've mentioned, one of the major activities that was most appreciated that NETEC used to do was on-site consultations. And basically, we would send a team of 3 to 5 of our subject matter experts to a given facility in order to review their policies, their procedures, look at their facilities, and make recommendations to assist them in their trip, in their journey toward biopreparedness. Obviously, that all came to a screeching halt in March of last year when COVID-19 presented. And so in recognition of that, NETEC is in the process of reorganizing our entire consultation process. We've done a comprehensive review and revision of existing consultation tools, and we've developed a dynamic self-assessment process to evaluate special pathogen preparedness looking primarily at frontline facilities, designated tiered facilities, long-term care facilities, and emergency medical services. And our goal is to offer customized technical assistance to facilities following their self-assessment, addressing their opportunities for improvement to, again, assist them in their journey toward being prepared. We anticipate this will launch in July of this year. On the next slide, we have had some interaction with domestic and international partners prior to this year, but courtesy of the ability to expand these activities in the current budget, we have engaged domestic and international partners to answer a lot of fundamental questions going forward. Such simple things as terminology. What is a special pathogen? How do we call a unit which would care for somebody who is infected with a special pathogen? And then to identify identify and evaluate the essential elements necessary to safely care for patients who have serious communicable diseases. And again, this is the journey that we're in the middle of this year. On the next slide, we will look at the second area that MEDTech performs its mission, namely education and resources. Prior to last March, MEDTech conducted a number of simulation courses and training sessions around the country, and actually had plans for about 20 to 30 of these when travel came to a screeching halt courtesy of COVID. And so we moved virtually. We continue to host webinars to address challenges and new information. Some of our upcoming webinars include COVID-19 variants, ICS during a pandemic, and apropos of what you've just heard from our colleagues in Nevada, outpatient monoclonal antibody therapy. And to date, we've had well over 20,000 participants in our webinars. And as Dr. Hunt mentioned earlier, these are chosen not to be in conflict with the ECHO program that ASPR is currently running, but rather to be complementary. In addition to webinars, we have a number of online resources. We have printable resources and infographics, which we have developed, including the hows and whys of mask wearing. We have developed Justin Training YouTube videos for individuals to watch. And we're proud to say that we estimate approximately 1 million YouTube views of our just-in-time training have occurred to date. We have a very interactive web-based personal protective equipment tool where individuals can go to this tool, put in what kind of activities they're doing, what kind of facility they're at, and the tool will recommend to them the personal protective ensemble, which is most appropriate for their activities. We've also taken a strong stand in social media messaging. One of the messaging campaigns that we did over the last couple of months was staying safe during the holidays. And no, this was not don't drink and drive. It was mask, distance, and use hand hygiene. We are also now working on a personal protective equipment message, which will address double masking for the lay public who do not have access to N95 respirators or approved procedure masks. Next slide. One of the things that we have done over the last several months is do a very thorough needs analysis of our customers, both by using surveys and by doing interviews. We have established what the needs are of healthcare workers in the United States. And based on that information, we have created four educational journeys for four types of users to basically target what type of interest they have in biopreparedness. And the four journeys that we're in the process of developing are firstly, infection prevention, secondly, frontline care of individuals who have a serious communicable pathogen, or in this case, COVID. Number three, just general pathogen awareness. And number four, emergency management. Our future activities in education will continue and include webinars. We're going to get involved in podcasts, in NETEC Live, in virtual learning, and in online resources and infographics. On the next slide, I have the third major way in which NETEC addresses US biopreparedness, and that's with our Special Pathogen Research Network, affectionately called SPRN. And SPRN is basically a tight integration of the 10 regional emerging special pathogen and treatment centers together with NETEC to add a research arm to issues involved in the management of serious communicable diseases, or most recently with COVID-19. Some of our initiatives, number one, many of you may be aware of the adaptive COVID-19 treatment trials known as ACT. And these were treatment trials which have been conducted over the last several months, looking at medical countermeasures which offer the best benefit for individuals infected with COVID-19. As you can see from the table on the bottom right-hand corner, roughly a third of all the patients involved in the three ACT studies that have been completed to date were enrolled by the Special Pathogen Research Network. We have also developed the Universal Protocol, which is a centralized waste specimen collection protocol, which supports distributed biobanks. We have a clinical characterization protocol for severe emerging infections, which is a prospective observational cohort study with a robust and adaptive biospecimen collection protocol and associated case report forms. And finally, we had the ZMAP extended access protocol, which was operational, but because of more recent data has been closed to enrollment. In terms of our scholarly activity, we have three completed manuscripts. There are six manuscripts which are currently in various forms of completion. We have presented four abstracts and two symposia presentations. SPRN has basically developed four working groups. We have a centralized IRB for all 10 of the centers so that when new protocols occur, they can rapidly be implemented by SPRN. We have a biorepository.
Yeah, go ahead. Well,
We have research operations. And then finally, we have state of the art. And so on the next slide, we thank you very much for allowing us to review for you the activities that NETEC has done to help to address the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Ribner. For those who have questions for Dr. Ribner, please feel free to submit them in the chat, or if you'd wish to ask a question live, you're more than welcome to raise your hand and you can feel free to unmute yourself and ask your question. Okay, I'm seeing no questions in the chat so far. I did want to point out very briefly that during the Nevada conversation, we did have quite a few links that were thrown in the chat. I know there is a link to the Nevada Crisis Standard of Care Plan website for an overview of their Crisis Standard of Care Plan and for additional information on EPON. I also did see that that there were a couple links thrown in for the New Mexico Medical Advisory Team website with links to crisis standards of care documents. So Sharon, thank you so much for dropping that in the chat as well.
So again, anybody who has any questions later on that they think about, or maybe they were too shy to address it over this large audience, NETEC.org. Is our website. And again, as I showed you in one of the earlier slides, you can address any questions you have through that vehicle.
Great, thank you. Okay, seeing no questions in the chat, to be respectful of all of your time, I will pass it over to Joe LaManna to close us out.
Yeah, my apologies. It's mute challenge, too many windows open. Thank you everybody for getting on the call today. I hope this information that we were able to provide you was of some value, and look forward to any of the follow-up questions that you may have after the fact. Please do let us know your thoughts. And with that, I'll wish you all a great afternoon, and look forward to the next call. Take care.
Thank you.